Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 36, being recorded on July 23rd, 2014. Topic today is going to be Hyper-V Recovery Manager. My name is Sujit Mello. I'm a consultant with Microsoft, focused on the app dev space. And as always, I have my two cohorts on the Skype with me, Kale and Evan. Guys?
Hey, this is Kale Teeter, MCS consultant from New York, focused on .NET development and Azure.
And this is Evan Basilik, and I'm out of North Carolina, doing support for Windows Azure IaaS out of the Windows team. And I got to say, Sujit, Kale and I must be really going downhill if we're cahoots now.
Cohorts.
I said cohorts.
I misheard that, but I really have a complex now.
Yeah, maybe awesome. I need to get my pronunciation right there. It's cohorts.
Oh, no, you're probably right. I'm feeling bad about missing the last couple.
Yeah, we missed you. Hopefully you had a good time away with the family and everything.
Three birthdays in 3 weeks, so don't show me any cake. But yeah, good to not be here.
That's great. Well, so we've got some interesting things to talk about today. The main topic we're going to discuss is Hyper-V Recovery Manager. But as always, let's get around to some tips and latest updates for Azure first, and then we'll get around to that topic. So the tip of the day of the week, I should say, for today is it relates to a common problem that customers have when trying to connect to the Azure SQL database. You know, typically you stand up an Azure SQL database and they get failures, and you know, support gets a lot of questions on this. Right, Evan?
Yeah, I did support for that product before I moved down to do Windows Azure IaaS. And I'd say KV is great because it covers a bunch of different scenarios and kind of walks you through the error that you would get and how to resolve it. But the one thing that I just call out is probably the most common thing that we saw, even for cases where that wasn't their core problem, we would still see that they had done it, was they hadn't upped the connection timeout, right? So by default, the SQL Server client libraries, which work for Azure SQL Database, default to 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. And for Azure SQL Database, the requirement is 30 seconds.
Wow, that's pretty low, the default 15 seconds, eh?
Yeah, I mean, it's because they have to go look up, like, exactly what physical server your database is living on.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some retry logic and everything just in case the first attempt fails. So they need some extra time to do it. I mean, again, this only, because you're connection pooling, it only hurts the first connection.
The first connection, yeah.
So you don't tend to see a whole lot of impact for it. But if if we do have a slight delay, we have to retry, your connection will time out, and then that's going to bubble up as an error at that point. So it's really important for people to do that.
So this happens only if SQL Azure was not started, right, for that particular tenant?
No, it's not really we may want to go back, and it'd be interesting to kind of do a deeper show on just specific Azure SQL Database, especially with some of the changes coming later this year. But Azure SQL Database is a bunch of SQL Server instances,
mm-hmm,
where we've kind of split up the databases under the covers for you. So it's just like a standard on-premises SQL Server database. It's always up and running. The distinction is that when you connect in to the Azure SQL Gateway, it has to go find out which of the, I don't know, 1,000 servers your database is actually on at that instant, right? Because it might have failed over, you know, there might have been a hardware problem, and that database will move around.
I see.
And, and we have the code has some logic to say, hey, I tried to look it up, and I got data that looks wrong, so I'm going to go try it again. And, you know, maybe that database is in the process of failing over, right? So we have to retry again in 10 seconds, right? There's all those scenarios where we don't always know where it's going to be, so we can't optimize getting there.
Got it.
So we just have that extra cushion built in.
Okay. Very good. That's really good to know that you need to tweak that timeout value. Okay. And As Evan mentioned, there is a KB article, which we'll put the link in the show notes, but that kind of walks you through some of the most common errors that you might get and what you should do to fix each one of them. There's not a whole lot. There's maybe 6 or 7 of them that you have to watch for. So we're going to put that tip in the show notes for our listeners. The second thing I wanted to bring up is this just came up the other day on our internal DL, and I really like this. It's I like reading these ebooks, and especially when they're free, they're really good. But this one's written by a number of authors, including our very own Scott Guthrie, Mark Sims, etc. There's a whole bunch of them, and it's Building Cloud Apps with Microsoft Azure. Right, best practices for DevOps, data storage, high availability, and more. I mean, this looks like, you know, it's all the good stuff over here. And it's primarily for developers. So if you're interested in, you know, taking your Azure skills to the next level, I think this book is where to go. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but I would be it's a little scary because Scott Gu, and I mean, you guys have seen him a lot. I don't know if the audience has seen some of his Channel 9 videos or anything, but he's super technical.
I know.
Right? Can you imagine being the PM who he's up demoing something and it just doesn't work the way he wants it, and then he shows up in your office the next day and says, okay, just change this, and now he has the authority to make it happen?
Yeah, I mean, at his level, I mean, he's still he can write code and give demos on stage, technical demos, very easily, which is amazing.
Yeah, it really bodes. I mean, I personally think that really bodes well for where that product, the overall Azure, is going, because you have somebody who actually like knows what they will want to do,
mm-hmm.
kind of driving the direction of some of that stuff. So,
yeah, he and Mark Rusinovich, I think, you know, same style.
Yeah. Yeah.
And both of them on the Azure team, so it says a lot.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, and then moving on to there's a couple of other white papers on cloud automation and a new Explain That to Me video series that has been put out on Channel 9 by some of our folks from Microsoft, and I'll put a link to it. The first show that they put out is on Office 365 identity and access controls. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But the really cool news that I wanted to bring out here today was on the new version of PowerShell, 0.8.5 has been released. And there's a lot of new stuff in there. I was kind of surprised. There is the Azure File Service, which we talked about in the past in one of our shows. There's some new commands for that. There's the Azure Resource Manager. The reverse DNS facility, which the guys were talking about it before, it's a really nice feature, because what reverse DNS allows you to do is, look up the DNS of your clients that are connecting into you in the cloud, and then do some kind of access control or take some action based on that DNS record. It's primarily used for security or for email authentication and things like that. So there's some support for that in PowerShell now. There's some additional support for the internal load balancer feature that we talked about last week. And then there's traffic manager support for weighted round robin policies and performance-based policies, which is kind of new, actually. And then there's some new role sizes. You know, we've introduced a whole bunch of new role sizes, so there's updates to that as well. So it looks like a lot of good stuff. And Kale, weren't you saying that we just came up with version 0.8.3 and now we're already at 0.8.5?
Yeah, that was back a couple weeks ago. Maybe it was a month ago. It wasn't that long ago that we were talking about, 8.3, and now we're at 8.5. So the product continues to go super fast. Trying to keep up with all these updates is quite a challenge.
It is. Challenge for all of us to just keep on top of it. Talking about reverse DNS, one of the other updates that came out was that now reverse DNS is supported for cloud services, both in IaaS and PaaS model. Okay. So it's not offered at no additional cost, and as we just discussed, there's a lot of applications can take advantage of that, just to do some sort of check or authentication in your app.
Yeah, so before you go on, I just wanted to touch base on that a little bit more. Like we were talking earlier, Evan and yourself, about where this is useful, and yeah, we talked about the mail. That's the big part where I used to see this in the past was on mail servers for like spam filters and things. People would spoof names, and if you do the reverse lookup and it doesn't jive, then you can say that this didn't come from a source that they're saying it came from.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one way, but I could see applications where this thing could actually work, right? If you had something in Azure, talking back to your on-premises system, potentially maybe you want to add another layer of security here to be able to do that reverse check on that. But it does rely on, just to be clear, it relies on those reverse zones in DNS. If people are familiar with pointer records, it's the opposite of a forward lookup. So instead of, you know, having an IP address and looking up a name, you're going the opposite way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the only thing I used to work, there's some guys on my team that used to do a bunch of DNS support. And the one thing that, I think we probably ought to point out is their, what's the phrase they use? They're not authoritative. So like you can't guarantee that if there's a PTR record that it actually is legit, but it just gives you a high likelihood at that point. Right, so it's not guaranteed.
Yeah, and I think it's about the layered approach, right? When you're like, especially with security, we always do many things that aren't guaranteed, but we're getting a better overall sense for if the security's good or not. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's just one more thing you can do, right?
Yeah, and another use case I was thinking about: if you're writing an app, and maybe the app for now you only want to allow customers, say, in the United States to access it. This might be a good way to check on that, you know, to check on the reverse DNS record to make sure that all the callers that are trying to get in and authenticate themselves are from the United States. I mean, I'm sure there's ways to spoof it if somebody really wants to do it, but at least this way you can kind of limit your user audience right away.
Yeah. Yep. No, good call out, Sajid.
So then moving on to some new Express Route locations, seven new ones actually, Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, New York, and Seattle in the States, and then in Asia, Hong Kong and Singapore. So they're really expanding very fast there. That's really good to know. And then finally, the Azure Active Directory SDKs, you know, so we do a lot of authentication in your apps. You could use these SDKs to authenticate with Azure, and now they've come up with SDKs for iOS, Android, and OS X. So you could use your I guess this is to do if you have an Office 365 or Azure Premium AD account, is that where this comes into play, Kale?
Yeah, I mean, if you have an application, if we're going to host an application backend up there in Azure and we don't have a user store, or we're planning to use Azure for that user store for both, you know, authorization and authentication, this makes it easy. You know, it's like a on-ramp to try to, you know, bridge that gap for iOS and Android. We already have, you know, obviously the Windows side of that fence. But having this other one there and being able to support that so that it's a few lines of code instead of writing a bunch of REST code,
right,
just to do these type of things. You know?
Excellent.
Yeah, I think the thing that jumps out at me when I see this is think about what the odds would have been, what, even 5 years ago, that we would have said, oh, you know, here's SDKs for all these third-party OS.
Good point. Right.
I think we had a whole show on it one time talking about how, you know, I think it was when we were talking about the naming change. Right?
Yeah.
We really, from a Microsoft Azure perspective, we don't care how you're coming in, you know, which OS, what device, what hardware, where you're coming. We're completely agnostic in that sense, which is really different for us as a company. So,
exactly. Yeah, good point. And it's I'm glad that they're doing that. It's very good. And then finally, this is really cool website that we came across. It's called the Azure Websites Cheat Sheet. And this thing has a wealth of information on Azure websites. I mean, every little PowerShell script you need to know, any configuration, how to set up custom domains, hosting MySQL, Python, you name it, it's all there. It's all on one web page, which is one big web page, but it's all in one place. And what's interesting is that I think if you want to add to it or update it, you can actually fork the web page on GitHub. and make updates to it. And I guess, you know, and they'll review that and put them back into the website. So it's kind of a community-driven wiki-style web page. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Okay, so let's talk about Hyper-V Recovery Manager. I mean, I got to confess, this is one of the topics that I know it came up before, but we haven't covered it. And I just wanted to maybe just at a high level understand, share with our listeners what this is, and more importantly, what it isn't. You know, what is the kind of problem that Hyper-V Recovery Manager is trying to solve compared to some of our other Azure backup style facilities that we offer. Evan, do you have any background on that?
Yeah, a little bit. So this actually kind of touches a little bit into the Windows Azure backup space. It actually leverages the same backend. It essentially gives you this customized blob storage, because, you know, like everything else, uses blob storage under the covers, where you can push the images of your Hyper-V virtual, your virtual machine manager machines, right, your Hyper-V hosts, into the recovery vault. And then at that point, you either have a backup that you can, you know, suck back into your on-premises, or you can use that to replicate this virtual machine to another on-premises site, right? So it kind of allows you to bridge. You now have this fully backed up, fully cloud, you know, place to back up these VMs, where before you would have to find a place on-prem. And if you have this massive disaster on-prem, well, your backups go with you. But now you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. I think one of the cool things too about the actual DR part of what you're talking about, Evan, is I think originally the way this product was designed was you have an on-premises data center running your stuff, and you know you could use this tool to fail over to Azure, so you could have it, you know, bring up those VMs up there. Stuff that was running on Hyper-V now runs in Azure. But I think now that's been changed a little bit, so you can actually do it like a secondary site like you're talking about. So you could have two data centers and have this thing orchestrate the failover between those, or it could go to Azure still, so that still works. So is that what you guys have heard as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the on-premises to Azure scenario, but I'm familiar with the on-premises to on-premises mm-hmm. site. I'll do some poking while we're talking about it, because I thought that was actually one of the things that rings a bell that I want to say that's a common misconception, but I could be wrong on that, so I'm going to do some digging while we're talking.
Yeah, I think it might actually be in preview. We could put a link out to this, but it's called Site Recovery. But basically it's saying that Azure can be your disaster recovery site. But again, I think it is still preview.
Okay. That may be why I'm not as close.
Is that part of the InMaj thing? Or is that something totally different? The InMaj acquisition that we did a couple of weeks ago? All right. And they provide, I suppose that is a disaster recovery for on-premises systems in Azure. So that's a totally different use case. Never mind. So this is completely related to this is Hyper-V images running in Azure itself, right?
And yeah, I mean, the way I understand it, and you guys can jump in here, but it essentially monitors through System Center. It's monitoring these machines, and it can continuously even monitor stuff on Azure, and it can replicate between these two, and then orchestrate, you know, failovers between the two.
Yeah, I think that's the part that jumps out at me is, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I know when I was doing SQL, we had a lot of engagements with customers, you know, where they were testing their DR and something didn't work on their DR, right? And we spent lots and lots of time and effort on this hypothetical situation, right? They didn't actually have a DR. They just wanted to make sure their DR worked. Well, now we have this orchestration, and we have that you can go, because you were right, Kel, you know, I found the link, but it is preview go to Azure. Now you don't even have to have your own DR site.
Yeah, this is huge. Like from that sense, my background before Microsoft, this was a big thing, right? Customers and the customer I worked for, they, you know, when you have your DR sites, and this was years ago, but we would always have less horsepower there. Because it was so expensive, you know, like we had millions of dollars of machines running in production, and we can't just duplicate everything. I mean, we could duplicate the network hardware, but the machines would always be, okay, if we had three or four web servers in production, we would have two there. So we could still run, right? But it would be in a reduced capacity state. And then the business would come back and say, are you sure we can handle the load? You know, if we fail over, let's test fail over. And like you said, then hilarity ensues when you try to do a test failover and things don't work right, you know?
Yeah.
So now with this option of, like, you're not even paying for that stuff to be running there, you know, so you only pay for it when you need it, just like everything else in the cloud. But
yeah,
I think it's cool.
I was going to say, I'm looking at the pricing and like, I think your point is so critical, Kale, is, I mean, people literally have millions of dollars, I mean, for big DR sites sitting there doing nothing. Right, and here we're charging $27 a month per VM.
Yeah,
I you know, I guess that's probably a little bit reduced because it's in preview still, but I mean that's nothing.
Yeah,
on a per machine basis.
And again, back to the point we were making, I think a week or two ago, about enterprises versus like a startup culture. Startup culture, I think this type of tool maybe doesn't apply quite as much to them because they're changing and evolving and making things so fast. Making backups and having, you know, standbys and stuff is good to do, but you know, when you're moving that fast, there's less of a need for this as opposed to a large enterprise where, you know, like you said, Evan, there's millions on the line and all those type of things.
So I would actually encourage people maybe to think about it in a slightly different perspective, which is, I don't know about you guys, but I run into a bunch of startups and, you know, cause a year or so ago before we did IaaS, right? Azure was all about greenfield development, right? Cause you couldn't drop your stuff into Azure PaaS roles like you can with Azure IaaS. And so we had a lot of startups and, you know, online companies and everything doing. And one of the things that I saw, they consistently seem to, even the ones that are just on premises, they consistently seem to skip, was they're like, we don't do DR, or we don't have a backup plan because we just, you know, we can't afford to put the hardware out, or we can't afford to do that. I actually think that some of the small and medium sized businesses, this actually, I think, would be something they ought to consider, right? Because, again, it's not huge money, but think about the impact if you don't have these capabilities and as a startup you do go down for some reason.
Yeah, I see your point. I mean, on, you know, and also manpower, right? So,
yeah,
you know, doing it by hand, having, you know, replicating things by hand just so you have a backup, you know, takes time. And when you're a startup, you don't have a lot of people. So,
yeah,
you know, that's more at a time. I was thinking more from the complexity sense. You know, typically they're moving really fast and doing things on the fly. And like you said, yeah, things happen sometimes. And, you know, I think as long as you're following the rules with Azure, you should be okay as from an SLA standpoint, you know, making sure you have redundant things up there.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely. I can see both sides of it. Definitely.
Yeah.
So just if we could just back up to that orchestration we're talking about with relates to Hyper-V Recovery Manager. So you basically set up your VMs to be replicated to Azure, right? To the Vault. Is that how it is? It starts off with?
Yeah.
So that replication is going on, and then at some point you have a disaster, right? Hopefully not, but let's say you do. What happens at that point? Like, how does things switch over to do they spin up the VMs in Azure at that point based on your cloud backup?
The way I understand it is you can customize what happens when that happens, Sajid. So there is a simple way to set it up where it would basically do this health check, and if it fails, it deems it's time to do a failover. It would basically spin those VMs up. But you can also have it execute scripts and do all kinds of, you know, custom logic, like workflow type stuff that you need to do in order to fire your environment up. Like maybe you say, I have to make sure the databases are all up first and then bring these things up. So orchestrating how things come online. It might be important to your environment. It might not. So the knobs and dials are there for you to tweak that. But there's also a simple mode too.
I got it. Okay. And you need a system standard to do this, right? I think on premises.
Yeah, you do. As well as, I mean, obviously Hyper-V, because these are virtual machines, but yeah. And I think there's actually, it has to be, I think, is it 2012 or 20, it's 2012 R2 for System Center.
System Center, okay.
Yeah, so if you got a slightly older one, you are going to want to look at 2012 R2.
So I'm going to sound like a sales guy right now, but I think this is one of the like important things that Microsoft can uniquely do with Azure. I mean, because we control the OS, we control the data, you know, in Azure. I mean, we own Azure, we built it, and we control that whole product line, the Hyper-V, System Center, everything. So getting that level of integration to be able to do these kind of systematic failovers, I'm sure there's third parties that can do it with a bunch of different tools, but we have the entire suite there to do it, which I think is pretty cool.
I didn't think that sounded too salesy, Cal.
It's a little bit, you know. I try not to be a sales guy. But.
Well, at least you didn't mention that, you know, it's this Hyper-V Recovery Manager is Microsoft's answer to VMware's Site Recovery Manager. that would have been too salesy.
Yeah, right.
But he didn't
right.
mention that.
Yeah. Yeah, in your defense, Kale, right, I sometimes think it's not even so much salesy as I think that's one of the really cool things about it, right? Mm-hmm. I can just take my VHC and pick it up and, not exactly, but mostly pick it up and drop it in it, and it works, right?
Yeah,
and now with the System Center stuff, it's seamless, right? You don't have to do all this special stuff to make it work.
Yep.
Yeah, no, that, I think that's super, super cool from a technical perspective. So,
excellent. And I did notice that there are some tutorials online which kind of allow you to kind of test this whole scenario, right? The tutorials talk about setting up a VM on premises, doing the replica, and then simulating a failure, you know, orchestrating the failover, because you have to test it, right? I mean, just.
Yep.
It's really no good.
I think that's my favorite part of this tutorial. And maybe it's part and parcel of a recovery manager tutorial, but I don't think I've ever seen a tutorial around this kind of stuff where it says, now try a failover.
That's right.
They just set you up and say, hey, you're set up now.
Yeah, like building clusters. You're like, okay, we got the cluster set up. Now, yank the heartbeat cable and see what happens.
just take out one of the hard drives.
Yeah. Yeah, that never seems to show up in the tutorials, right? That's just assumed at that point. So, yeah, that's cool.
Very good. Okay, that's great. Thanks, guys. Certainly got a better picture in my mind. Hopefully our listeners got something out of that. All right, good. So Evan, I heard we've got some good speakers lined up for the next few shows.
Yeah, actually, obviously, unfortunately, you two won't be able to make it for this, but, you know, we are doing an Azure Bootcamp here in North Carolina, actually on the Microsoft campus in Charlotte. And, we've got a couple of the coordinators for the bootcamp who are, one of them's an Azure MVP and one of them, he specializes in Azure for a company by the name of Aditi, mm-hmm. I've seen them. They do, you know, some products and some content and stuff, but I'm not hugely familiar with them. I think they're a consulting firm. But, we've invited them to come on and talk a little bit about the bootcamp, but also to, you know, talk about the things that they see from their perspective, what customers are doing with IaaS and PaaS, right? Which is going to be a slightly different flavor of what we see here, but I'm really excited to get them to come in and kind of give us their opinions on what's going on. And also to plug myself, I am giving two talks at this conference, one on IaaS troubleshooting and one on virtual networking in Azure. So if you're in the vicinity, we'd love to have you. I will put the link for the bootcamp in the podcast link so that if anybody is in the area, please come visit.
That would be great. Just to see Evan's presentation is well worth it, guys. I'm telling you. I have seen his presentation internally, and it's really nice. So. That was very nice, your whole IaaS presentation. Okay, so that's coming up in the next few weeks, and we're all very excited to have all those discussions with those speakers. And we've got a bunch of other exciting speakers coming up. We're going to try and get a lot of internal folks on Microsoft to come onto the show and maybe give us their perspective. These are, you know, experts in various areas in Azure, who can perhaps give us a different, more in-depth view into some of the areas within Microsoft Azure. All right. Well, thanks, guys, for everything, as always. And we'll see you guys next week.
Sounds great. See you guys.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.